This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is derived from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. And emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with Henry Bushkin. For 18 of the 31 years that John William Carson dominated the small screen like no other performer before or since with The Tonight Show, Henry Bushkin was his lawyer and identified by Mr. Carson as his closest friend. He's been with us a few times, but it's always topical talking with Henry about Johnny Carson's relevance then and the impact of him on contemporary America all these years later. If you'd like to join us again, 877-217-5757. And 31 years ago this week, Johnny Carson departed the stage as host of The Tonight Show, and it is difficult for those of us who grew up watching him to absorb the fact that he's now been off the air just a bit longer than he was on The Tonight Show as host. His reign began October 1st, 1962 in New York City. Henry joined him in 1970 in New York. They moved to Los Angeles 2 years later, but Henry is back in the great city of New York, and he wrote his book, a bestseller 10 years ago, about Johnny Carson. And since that decade ago, he has unearthed many more facts about Mr. Carson. He's made it a quest in his life to find out a man of great mystery who was viewed by millions but known by very few. And good morning to you, Henry Bushkin.
Hey, good morning, Jim. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
The other day when I was watching the debate with Caitlin Collins, I guess you'd call it a debate, it was a town hall meeting with Ms. Collins, who's been promoted at CNN, by the way, by virtue of her performance. She did, I thought, a credible job interviewing Donald Trump, but I was thinking that probably the best person to go toe-to-toe with Trump would be a fellow performer, and that perhaps the best person of all, if he were still with us, would be John William Carson. Carson was an underrated interviewer, and of course he could joust with people who wanted to get off topic and make it a whimsical affair or an outrageous event. He was very good at rolling with the flow, was he not, Henry Bushkin?
Of course, he conducted 22,000 interviews during his tenure on The Tonight Show during a 30-year period, and I think Donald Trump would have been one of 22,000, but I think Donald had a great respect for Carson to begin with, because they knew each other for quite some time. As I did. And so I think it would have been a really good interview, and I don't think Carson would have permitted Donald to go off on a ramp as he did against Caitlin Collins.
Now, Johnny Carson knew Donald Trump, actually lived in Trump Tower, as I believe you did. How well did Mr. Carson know Donald Trump? I think we know the answer, and we're trying to get Henry to a better location. Robin Dow, our producer, is doing that as we speak, so we'll let them adjust. But how well did Carson and Trump know each other, Henry?
Hello, Jim? Yeah,
yes, how well did they know one another?
They knew each other very well. As a matter of fact, both Johnny and I bought apartments at Trump Tower. And we bought them before it was even constructed, because we were both friendly with Donald, and he convinced us that this is going to be a great building, and we both bought apartments there. I sold mine long before Johnny did. As a result, Johnny and Trump had a long-standing relationship, because they both lived in the same building in New York.
And you told me that shortly after your book, which appeared 10 years ago, 2013, Joan Rivers dies in 2014, and you're at the funeral, and you run into one Donald John Trump, and the first thing he says is?
No one knew Johnny better than you and I did, Henry, which was a typical Donald Trump remark.
Well, Donald knew them all the big entertainers, and Carson, of course, he got to know everybody as well. And he was a pretty good judge of character. I love some of the lines going back 10 years, but the one about Elvis Presley, Johnny Carson said, if life were fair, Elvis would be alive and all the impersonators would be dead. And
Exactly.
But what did he go ahead, I'm sorry.
And that was one of his more famous quoted lines about Elvis. And I actually met Elvis with Carson backstage at the Sahara Hotel when Carson was working, and Elvis came to watch the show and was invited backstage, of course. And that was in 1972. It was like a big highlight of my life meeting this guy.
Yeah, and he was still in his prime then. Elvis would have been 37, and Johnny Carson.
Yeah, exactly. He was working, I think, at the International Hotel, mm-hmm. and Carson was at the Sahara, and it was my first trip to Las Vegas to go over things with Carson, and he had arranged for me and a couple of other people to go see the Elvis show at the International. So it was quite a weekend.
Now, Johnny Carson and Elvis Presley ran in the same circles to some extent, although Carson was 17 years older. But you revealed on the last appearance on our show that they had a common denominator and that they both had a relationship with Ann Margaret.
And the Ann Margaret relationship with Johnny I knew about because it was sort of indirectly involved in that. But I think Elvis and Ann Margaret were a little bit before Johnny
yes.
had a relationship with her.
Well, Johnny was married four times. You handled at least one of his divorces, and he led a full life, shall we say. And he, unlike David Letterman, wasn't foolish enough, to my knowledge, to get involved with people on his staff. But he certainly, based on what you and others have revealed, he was not immune to courting some of the people who were guests on his program.
Unfortunately, that was true. But in that era, in the 60s, the 70s, it's not necessarily a good thing by any stretch of the imagination, but that was sort of common with male stars at the time. You could Bob Hope, Carson, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, every one of them was sort of that ilk during that time.
As I mentioned, Carson, I think, was an underrated interviewer because his talents were prodigious and he was an amazing comic. And he had a great presence, but he could also ask a question, and he was not a person who asked a five-minute question and got a five-second answer. But here he was, Robin Dow, our producer, has pulled this. It was a 47-minute interview in 1968 on The Tonight Show, January 31, 1968, with Jim Garrison, the DA in New Orleans. Of course, it was the focus of Oliver Stone's movie a generation later, starring Kevin Costner in the Garrison role. But Carson, after hearing Garrison out for 47 minutes at the end of the interview, to show you how Johnny Carson summed it up, like few others, and a jury a few months later would acquit Clay Shaw in just a few hours of deliberation. Here's Carson closing his interrogation of Mr. Garrison.
And the seven gunmen carried this out with precision, firing from various points that day in Dallas. Which is a remarkable feat in itself, and it disappeared into thin air with no witnesses who ever saw any other gunmen or getaway vehicles, and a gigantic conspiracy in which nobody seems to yet prove anything. You ask us to believe that. I find that a much larger fairy tale than to accept the findings of the Woman Report.
Let me reply to you by saying, first of all, that these men did not disappear into thin air. A number of them were arrested, and I just showed you pictures of them being arrested. I presume you accept that as a fact. You can see them in the pictures.
No, sir, I don't accept that as a fact. I don't know who those men are, and I don't know for what reason they were arrested. And how can you say that the assassins were arrested and then turned loose? Isn't that the same?
Some of them were arrested, yes. Now, let me go on.
And then were subsequently turned loose.
They were turned loose later in the afternoon. Now, yes, let me go to the second point. The second point is...
I think we get the picture that Carson did not accept without contesting it, information provided by Mr. Garrison, who may have been right about some things, but I think history has proved he was wrong about most. And if you are listening to that, the quality is not great. And one of the reasons, and Henry can talk about this when we come back from the break, is that many of Carson's programs, especially in the early years, they were taped over by NBC. There is no video recollection of those programs, which is a real tragedy. And of course, NBC lost millions as a result of taping them over, but we'll talk about that and more when we return. The unmistakable theme of the Tonight Show for 31 years with John Carson, who was the host, and Henry Bushkin, known by many who never saw or heard Henry Bushkin for most of those 31 years, even though he was at Carson's side for 18 of them as the bombastic Bushkin. He is with us. He wrote the definitive biography about John William Carson 10 years ago. He's written prolifically about him since, and likely there will be another published book soon, and it has information we've discussed on this program about Carson's war service during World War II in the Navy, and his tenure as a boxer and when he was in the service, which may have given him CTE, which caused problems in his life. Carson had a full life with four marriages. He was the biggest star in the history of television. And he dominated the stage for 31 years and left at the top of his game in 1992, 31 years ago this week, when he was 66 years old. Henry Bushkin, we were talking about the tragedy of many of those early shows have been destroyed. And unless somebody taped it audio, the Garrison Carson interview, there's no evidence that those shows ever happened other than we know who was on them. And I think they preserved the first show, but many others gone by the wayside. What an awful decision that was.
And it came down to a question of storage. They were kinescopes at the time, and some genius at NBC made the decision that the early shows from 1962 right up to about 1968 or 1969 were taking up too much space, so they got rid of them. And television history was lost to a great extent for almost 8 or 9 years of those shows.
When we look at Carson in the 60s and then look at him in the 90s, there was a transformation, as happens with all of us. And it much reminded me of the transformation of Muhammad Ali from this slim, fast-as-lightning boxer to, at the end of his career, still the baddest guy on the planet, but he was bulky, and his ability to take a punch and his stamina and his strength, those became the factors that made him great, not the fact that he was swifter than anybody else. And Carson, through the years, most people that I've talked to, they think he actually had more of a television presence later than earlier, and arguably even looked better in 1992 than he did in 1962, Henry?
Well, in 1962, he was sort of a rail-thin six-footer, and by the time he retired in 1992, he had bulked up a little bit, but was in great shape. And obviously, being on the air basically every night for 30 years, he had to do a lot to maintain the look, the body image, and so on. So he was very careful, as every actor would be. I mean, that's nothing unusual.
A listener notes that he had a line of menswear. He certainly was a fashionable fellow.
Yeah, that line of menswear was very successful, and it had a a short-lived life because Johnny at some point refused to pose any longer for ads. He hated still photography. He liked television, but didn't like posing for still photography, which is it's sort of unbelievable mm-hmm. that you would end a good business because you didn't like taking photographs, which is exactly what happened.
Got a few questions from listeners, and if you'd like to get under the wire with Henry Bushkin, Carson's sure. attorney, an 18-year stint. The two of them worked together, and they were socialized together, and Carson personally identified Henry as his closest friend. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Here's one from Hal in Monroe. How would Carson have handled the writer's strike? He was a gifted writer himself, but it's tough when your staff goes on strike, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. I was involved, I think it was 1981, when there was another writer's strike. And, of course, The Tonight Show was the most immediately affected because it was a daily show. And what we did then, and I think what should be done now, is get a concession from the Writers Guild, let The Tonight Show go forward, and whatever the ultimate agreement is between the producers and the writers, that would go into effect for The Tonight Show. So in 1981, I think the strike lasted maybe 2 months. And we were back on, The Tonight Show is back on the air after a week. So I think that's mm-hmm. possible today as well.
Another listener, Tracy at the Capitol, asks about the 1980 inaugural with, I guess, 81 inaugural with Ronald Reagan. Carson was scheduled, I think, to be the MC. What happened?
He was the MC. He was the MC, he didn't like the weekend for any number of reasons, but particularly because Frank Sinatra produced that event, and Johnny was unhappy with the performers who were performing at the inauguration. But he did do a yeoman's job as the host, and then after the show, he got quite upset at the director, Marty Pesetta, who cut parts of his monologue at the beginning of the show. So in 1981, he was there, and he did do the hosting of that inaugural.
Here's one from Tom on Bluebonnet asking if Carson had a list of people he didn't want on the show at the end of his tenure.
Well, I would say before the end of his tenure, he had a lot of people that he didn't want on the show and didn't come on the show because he didn't think they were good interviewers, or he just personally didn't like them. So, yeah, that happened on occasion.
What happened with him and Rich Little?
Rich Little was never one of his favorites. It was that simple. He didn't quite think he was as good as most people thought he was. So there was a little tension between the two of them. But professionally, I think they always got along.
Okay. Now, what about your tenure with him? You saw him at his best and at his worst, and you saw him when he was off the air as well. And when you wrote the book, there was a lot of your interpersonal exchanges. A lot of that was portrayed and depicted in the book. But since then, you found out much, much more about him. Has it been an enlightening journey for you the last decade?
Much more so, actually, than the 18 years that I was with him, simply because there was no internet then. There was no ability to go into the background of someone like Johnny Carson. We had the Encyclopedia Britannica, basically, as a reference. So because of all the information that's available today and subsequent to the publishing of my book, I've learned so much more about Carson, and I have so much more affection for him now than I did then because of what he went through to get The Tonight Show back in 1962.
And you've written much about it. And by the way, the work that has not yet been available for public consumption is quite impressive. Can we expect a published version of round two of Johnny Carson?
Absolutely. I'm hoping it will be either for Christmas this year or for Father's Day next year.
Well, Henry Bushkin, when you walk that city of New York where you now live again, do you think of Carson?
You know, I do, because I live on the east side and he lived on the east side. He lived at United Nations Plaza. So I'm in the same neighborhood today that he was then. And we walk the same streets. And yeah, it's look, 30 years or 31 years after the last show and 40 years or so after my last exchange with him, I have a lot more affection for him today than
Henry, thank you so much. We'll be calling again soon, and we're back with more after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Tyler Bridges is with us, covers the Capitol, and we'll be covering the gubernatorial campaign of 2023. And we are 20 weeks away from Saturday. It'll be 20 weeks until October 14th. And as soon as the session is over, I think most of the attention will be on the aspirants for governor, although most of the statewide offices are open. Only two incumbents are running for re-election, Mike Strain, the agriculture commissioner, and Billy Nungesser, the lieutenant governor, who is slated to be with us Friday. Your number is 877-217-5757. And Tyler Bridges, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
And at the Capitol, like the nation's capital right now, there is a discussion about debt limits. And where is that going?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is to make sure everybody understands these are two completely different issues. In Washington, it's to raise the debt ceiling to be able to borrow more money for spending that Congress has already approved. Here in at the state capitol in Baton Rouge, the question is whether the legislature is going to lift a limit. It's called the expenditure limit that is not allowing that would not allow the legislature to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in money for what the Senate and the governor want to spend on one-time needs, like for infrastructure, roads, bridges, fixing up things at LSU, and restoring the coast.
877-217-5757. We've been hearing that things will be okay on both fronts, in Baton Rouge and in the Beltway, but right now there's still work to be done, isn't there?
Yeah, the legislative session ends on June 8th. So really, the whether the legislature is going to raise the expenditure limit is really the single most important issue. And again, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake. The conservatives in the House want to spend the extra money mm-hmm. on paying down retirement debt. They say that's a good long-term investment for the state. But again, the Senate, led by Paige Cortez, the president, and the governor say, no, it's a much better investment to take this money and these backlogs that the state has in roads and deferred maintenance at universities and paying for the coast is a much better investment.
And in Washington, with a week to go before this collision is possibly going to occur, Garrett Graves is now carrying the water for House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and Graves is getting a lot of attention nationally. He's a persuasive individual, and he is on the same page as the speaker. And even though the Republicans allowed the debt ceiling to be raised three times under President Trump, they are making noise now, and they want to deal with President Biden, who's trying to work with him. And we'll see where it goes. But Garrett Graves has suddenly become as big a player as maybe even more so than Steve Scalise. This is an amazing development, isn't it?
Yeah, Jim, it's a fascinating story, and it reinforces a belief that I have that if you succeed in Louisiana politics, you are playing in the major leagues, that what it takes to get ahead in Louisiana politics are really, really amazing skills. So Louisiana already has the number two Republican in the House. Mike Johnson from the Shreveport-Bossier area is very high up in the House hierarchy as well, and all of a sudden now, Garrett Graves, just elected in 2014, has now become a very trusted advisor for Speaker McCarthy and is now the liaison for the Speaker with the White House. And again, you look at the list of powerful men who've gone up to Washington, and maybe women will be doing it soon as well, and Julia Letlow, but to show that the skills they learned in Louisiana really served them well in Washington.
Were you surprised at all that Graves did not run for governor?
I think he was torn. I think there's still that feeling of having all the power of the governor, and he could be in his hometown, Baton Rouge. But he has spent a lot of time in Washington, and I think he clearly enjoys the work up there. And the belief is he sees a path for himself to either run against Bill Cassidy when he's up, or maybe Cassidy doesn't run again, or maybe down the road John Kennedy when he chooses not to run again. But Graves is obviously a guy who's very rooted in doing the nation's work in Washington.
His mentor, Billy Tozan, I saw him a few months ago, and he indicated to me that he would not be shocked at all if Garrett Graves ran against Bill Cassidy in 2026. That's 3 years away, but Cassidy irritated a lot of conservatives in Louisiana who liked Donald Trump a lot by voting for his impeachment and then voting to uphold the election. Garrett Graves voted against impeachment and voted to negate the election. And as a result of that, he is probably positioned well in Louisiana. Those votes will likely not hurt him at all. They will most likely help Garrett Graves in our state. But yet he is viewed as a centrist. And how is that the case when his voting record is almost identical to that of Clay Higgins, Tyler Bridges?
I think the difference is that Clay Higgins, like Jeff Landry, they have jumped on these national culture warrior issues, and like the president, former President Trump, has made an issue of, and again, the far right Republicans, and Graves has stayed away from those issues. So he's voted as a solid conservative, but those high profile issues, he's shied away from them.
And a listener notes, says, give me a break, Jim. Garrett Graves is on the front page as a negotiator in the debt ceiling all over the country. And Clay Higgins was on the front page last week for jostling with a protester. And it was a pretty lame protester, by the way. But Robin Dow, ever ready at the trigger, I think we can go back a week and we can hear Clay Higgins in all his glory silencing a protester.
Aren't you a congressperson touching me?
Yes,
get off
sir.
Me. You hurt
yes,
me.
Sir,
you hurt me. Get
yes,
off
sir.
Me. Get off me.
Yes, sir.
Clay Higgins, get off me. What are you trying to do, Clay Higgins?
Stand by.
Tyler, Clay Higgins is a character, isn't he?
He absolutely is. Some people will note that he remained calm, and I guess he relied on his police training in there, but obviously, there are a lot of people who think that he should have let the police address that issue, but I'm not surprised that Clay Higgins would jump in there. That's pretty much is the way he does things.
I love the way the protester was going, Clay Higgins, Clay, Clay Higgins, Clay Higgins, in case you didn't know it was Clay Higgins. But Clay Higgins is a guy who is overpoweringly popular. I think he won his congressional district. And he actually had a real opponent at a bigger margin than Garrett Graves did. So that tells you something about his mojo in Acadiana. And I was surprised to some extent that Clay Higgins didn't get in the governor's race. I think he, like him or not, would have been a formidable figure in this race if he had chosen to run.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm sure it was Jeff Landry was very much hoping that Higgins wouldn't get in. And I guess behind all of this is the shadow of Donald Trump. Jeff Landry was at the Capitol yesterday testifying on a bill, controversial bill involving libraries. And I grabbed him in the hall afterwards and said, well, how do you feel about the fact that Trump has endorsed you? And now he's not only under indictment, but has also been found guilty in a civil case involving sexual assault. And Attorney General Landry said to me, well, Trump is very, very popular in the state. He's got a good brand. And so I think for now, Attorney General Landry and I guess Clay Higgins, they're riding that brand. And it's going to be interesting to see how that rides out if Trump has more legal problems.
And as you stated, Jeff Landry is not shying away from his culture war, and he was at the Capitol. How did his appearance go yesterday?
I think from his point of view that it went well. The bill was passed. It's now advancing to the House floor, and this is the way that Jeff Landry has established himself as the solid Trump-like conservative in the race, and that's one of the reasons he's the front runner at this point in the governor's race.
And when I look at the breakdown of the vote on that bill, it was, I think, right along party lines. Every Republican on the panel voted for the bill to tighten access to certain library materials, and every Democrat, the three of them were on the panel, Brass of Vacherie, Phelps of Shreveport, and Jefferson of Homer, they all voted no on Senate Bill number 7. It's a case in which he's riding a wave. But is this reflective of the people of Louisiana, Tyler Bridges? These positions are so out there that some believe that they're not even in the mainstream of a conservative state like ours.
No, and there are people who say, hey, the main issues of the state are focusing on the economy, keeping kids in the state rather than leaving, finding qualified workers. The police forces don't have enough workers and those sorts of issues, and that the legislature is spending too much time on these cultural issues. But clearly, these issues are important for the Republican base, and we're seeing this not only in Louisiana, but in Republican-led states throughout the country.
And if Landry were to become governor, do you think that this would continue, or will he, like most other governors, end up having to watch the budget more than anything else?
Well, of course, he'd have to spend a lot of time on the budget, but Jeff Landry has shown that he really cares about these issues. I think there would be every reason, if he ends up winning the governor's race, to expect it him to continue on these things.
There is much percolating at the Capitol. There's a story today above the fold on Section A about bills targeting foreign land ownership and how a House pass measure draws protests. Sam Carlin wrote the story, but I'm sure Tyler is following it as well. And once again, it is about this aversion to outsiders. Is the legislature going overboard? Is it being xenophobic to the extreme? We'll talk about it when we return. 877-217-5757 is your number. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being part of Talk Louisiana. And if you're so inclined, emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. And our phone number, as always, is 877-217-5757. We're spending a bit more time with Tyler Bridges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who covers the Capitol for The Advocate and The Picayune. And I noted that today in The Advocate front page, above the fold, bills target foreign land ownership. House pass measure draws protests. The Louisiana legislature, writes Sam Carlin, is advancing a slate of bills that seek to ban certain foreign adversaries, including Chinese companies and people, from buying land in Louisiana. Part of a national effort largely pushed by Republican-led states to prevent foreign actors from buying up important land, the bills have garnered a wave of opposition and protests from Chinese American citizens, including college professors, who say the legislation is discriminatory and could threaten their ability to buy homes either through law or through discrimination from sellers. And at least three Republican lawmakers are pushing bills targeting foreign land ownership. And one bill in particular from Valerie Hodges, which cleared the House 78-22 this week, would ban anyone tied to the government's of China, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Russia, and Venezuela from buying or leasing property in Louisiana. Tyler Bridges, this is certainly a bold move by the legislature, but some would say an imprudent one. What do you think?
Yeah, Jim, I was struck in reading my colleague Sam Carlin's article, some of the language by Representative Valerie Hodges, who represents Livingston Parish, that her bill is fighting against communistic countries. and that China is waging a stealth war. And it kind of reminded me of the language we used to hear during the Cold War. And so I guess we're moving into a new Cold War, not with Russia, but with China. And I was in a kind of a strange way. I was glad to see the protesters out there, not because they were specifically trying to oppose this bill, but just it's nice that they have that right to do that in this country, because I think that if you come from China, you probably don't have that right.
I remember a few years ago, some Chinese interests bought not only Donald Trump's childhood home in Queens, but they bought the New York Military Academy, where Trump went to school, along with Stephen Sondheim, by the way. And so the Chinese own the New York Military Academy. I'm not so sure that's something that's going to change the world, but some people are concerned about it, and certainly Representative Hodges does not want Chinese infiltration in lovely Livingston Parish, so we'll see where it goes. But it is interesting, the battles the state legislature picks. And when I mentioned xenophobia to the extreme, let's go back to 1991. Tyler Bridges won awards, justifiably so, for covering one David Ernest Duke, who was riding high. In 1991, he got 671,000 votes when he ran for governor. Many of those people are nowhere to be found now, but they voted for him, and some of them are still around, believe it or not. And David Duke got a majority of the white vote, both for the governor's race in 91, the Senate race in 1990. Without the wisdom of black voters, we would have had Senator Duke and Governor Duke in Louisiana. But here we are 32 years later, and Tyler Bridges, some of the same battles that were being waged in 1991 are being waged today. It is sobering for those of us who... That's half a lifetime ago for me, and more than half a lifetime ago for you. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a long history in this country of fear, fear-mongering, fearful of other people. Back in during David Duke's heyday, you know, and I tell this story in my book, The Rise and Fall of David Duke, it was the fear that black people were taking jobs that white people deserved, or positions at universities. And those feelings were raw then. Of course, those issues haven't completely gone away. And now, because of the growing tension that our country has with China, we're seeing now someone like Valerie Hodges, and there's a couple other legislators pushing, conservative legislators pushing bills that I think a lot of people view as xenophobic against you know, foreigners that from countries that that we don't like.
And here is John Neely Kennedy last week in the United States Senate dumping on the country of Mexico.
Our economy is $23 trillion. Mexico's economy is $1.3 trillion. Ours is 18 times bigger. We buy $400 billion every year from Mexico. Without the people of America, Mexico, figuratively speaking, would be eating cat food out of a can and living in a tent behind an outback.
And the Advocate in its editorial pages said Kennedy embarrassed our state, but I don't see any apology from Senator Kennedy. I think he's basically proud of what he said, Tyler.
Senator Kennedy, I think he's very careful in how he chooses his words. I'm sure he thought this out in advance and just didn't think of it off the top of his head. And language like that has proven to be very popular with many people in the state. As you well know, Jim, last year he cruised to reelection with almost 62% of the vote and outpaced Donald Trump's percentage in 2020. So what Kennedy is doing is working in the state.
And a listener notes that Kennedy, who was born in Centerville, Mississippi, 1951, when he graduated from high school in 1969 at Zachary High, his congressman was John R. Rarick, born in Indiana, served four terms, and was a member, proudly, by the way, of the Ku Klux Klan, and he represented Baton Rouge and the surrounding area in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1967 to 1975. Patrick and Ennis Wald. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, John Rarick was used to pair with David Duke at his rallies. And
I remember.
And when he was running for governor, yeah.
I remember he was his Ed McMahon.
Yeah, yeah. He would set up. He would set up Duke's speech. Yeah.
Yeah, he master of ceremonies, and Duke would introduce Mayor Rarick as the greatest congressman in Louisiana history. Patrick in Ennis Wald Estates. Patrick, you're on with Tyler Bridges.
Hey, two quick things. As an American of Cuban descent, my mother was born in Cuba, and I have a lot of Cuban relatives. I totally support preventing communists from buying property in Louisiana. They took Americans' property in Cuba, and they took my grandfather's electric plant plus his dairy farm. So I have no problem with stopping the communists. It has nothing to do with Cubans. It has to do with stopping communists. Nothing with Chinese. Stopping communists. Get to my question, though. Barbara Freeberg is...
Freiberg.
This hadn't gotten a lot of press. Barbara has introduced another crime prevention district in the LSU area that's going to cost property owners $5,000, according to WBRZ, a year. And what concerns me about this is that a resident can vote on this property tax, not even own property in there. They could be renting. And then the actual business owner who owns the property doesn't live in the district, has no vote whatsoever, yet they're going to pay the tax. So you got people that...
All right. All politics, as Tip O'Neill said, are local. But I don't know about $5,000 a year. That's a lot of money. But Barbara Freiberg and others are concerned about crime. And how much of an issue will crime be? And have you heard anything about that particular bill, Tyler?
I haven't heard about that particular bill, but we're seeing obviously a lot of members.
In the election.
Yeah, obviously. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of legislators, particularly the conservatives, in this year in the legislative session, and Barbara, Representative Freiberg, is a Republican, are pushing these various measures. Maybe there'll be some pushback from residents like Patrick, the caller, but I think particularly interesting will be see will there be any pushback on Jeff Landry in the governor's race saying, hey, you're the attorney general. What have you been doing about crime?
That's true. And he's made crime his top issue to this point. And he has been the chief law enforcement officer in the state for the last 8 years. He even said some insensitive things about Hiller Moore. And I'm sure the district attorney in Baton Rouge was not pleased with that, Tyler.
Yeah, well, there's a number of people across the state who definitely do not want Jeff Landry to be governor, but he obviously has a fervent base of people who like him.
As you see the race now, 20 weeks out, how do you look at it?
I'll repeat the same thing I've said before, Jim, which is I'm keeping an absolute open mind. Jeff Landry is the front runner at this point. He's raised the most money. He's got the most important endorsements. But in open elections in Louisiana, the history shows that anything can happen, and frequently the front runner fades for one reason or another. So there are scenarios under which all of the candidates can win, although you know some of the lesser candidates have fewer paths to victory. But
if the election were this Saturday, Sean Wilson would almost certainly run first. So some might call him the front runner, but Landry would almost certainly run second if the election were this Saturday. Things can change, but Sean Wilson is a candidate. Jeff Landry wants to be in a runoff. He'd rather be in a runoff with him than with a fellow Republican. I'm surprised that there isn't a move to try to get another Democrat in, and I'm sure there may be some moves behind the scenes, but whatever is being done doesn't seem to be working, Tyler.
Well, not yet, but as you noted, there's still 20 more weeks, so there's still a lot of time for things to play out. Obviously, the public's not fully engaged in the race. The TV advertising hasn't begun, and I think really the race won't get joined until after qualifying in August.
And watch Gary Chambers. He says he won't run against Sean Wilson, but if he did, it would be a case in which he would be a nightmare for Wilson and in his base of support, so we'll see. Tyler, always a pleasure. Let's talk again soon. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Until tomorrow, for Rob and Dow, thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.